Colonel Churchill, Reel 3. Now, you were saying you'd asked Colonel Manners if he had his field dressing.
Yes. One of the things I had impressed on everybody in the commando right from the start was never use your first aid dressing to bind up the wound of another man. He has got a first aid dressing, and if the man is wounded and you go to help him, use his dressing to bind up his own wound. You must keep your own dressing for yourself. So don't forget that. As soon as you help somebody, get his field dressing, which is in a special pocket on his right groin. Everybody had it in the battle dress. There's a specially made pocket, which was a small one, which would hold as a tight fit so that he couldn't fall out, the first field dressing. So use the man's dressing for his own wound and retain your own for one day when you're wounded. That is most important. So that's why I said to Manners, where's your dressing? And he said, it's there in the usual place. So I said, right. And I took it out and started to tie Manners up. At this moment, Roger Wakefield was also wounded. These two, of course, had been standing up and running atop of a hill, and so the bullets which are going so closely over our heads were able to hit them, and they had, as a result, both been hit. Now, Roger Wakefield was rather closer and came back to us on his own and said, I've been hit as well. So I said, righto, Roger, where's it? It was fairly dark, of course, but there was a bit of a moon. And I knelt up to deal with Roger. At this moment, a Marine came up from behind and joined us, an odd Marine. And I said, help me with binding up this officer, which he started to do. A few moments later, he was hit in the head and collapsed on top of Wakefield. Now, the only thing that Wakefield said, we then moved this Marine who'd been shot in the head, who was lying on top of Wakefield, off him. And Wakefield said, has anybody got any morphia? And I said, yes, Roger, I have, because all officers had a small cardboard box of ampules of morphia with a sharp pin in the point of them. Only officers had these things. And if a man was in pain, you were to inject him with this and then make a mark with a chinagraph pencil on his forehead to show that he'd been injected. So when they were in the hands of the medicos later, they knew if a man had already been given one slug of morphia. So I said, right. And I was just about to do this. In fact, I think I did it. And Roger lay there. So now, both Manners and Wakefield, who'd gone to try and discover where the 43 were back again with me and both wounded. I then thought the time had come to play a pipe tune. But I didn't naturally stand up to do it. I rolled over onto my back, which you can do perfectly well, and I played the pipes lying down on the ground. And the tune I played was, Will Ye No Come Back Again? Now, this tune was heard by some people. The main person who heard it was Admiral Sir Walter Cowan, who recognized it at once and said to the others at headquarters there, ah, there's Jack playing his pipes, and he's playing Will Ye No Come Back Again. I think that sounds rather sinister. Anyway, nobody came back, And when I finished the tune, I merely stopped.
So you'd really done it as a signal to get...
What?
You'd really done it as a signal, had you, to get re... You'd really done it as a signal.
Yes, to try and get these people back and to indicate, because I was the only one who could play the pipes, to know that there were some people on top of the hill and that I was among them, as the brigade commander, was on top of the hill. And I wanted whoever was about anywhere, and that is why Manners and Wakefield had gone off to discover what odd troops of 43 who were attacking the hill, where they were on top of the hill. I knew, I thought they were dotted about in different places. But once I played the pipes and they could hear the pipes, they would know that that I was there as the commander of the whole shooting match, and that there was a force on the hill, and I hoped they'd converge on me. Well, there was a good deal of mortaring also from the Germans, but whereas the rifle and machine gun fire was passing very close over our heads, the mortars were falling all over the place. And some of us, there were about 8 or 10, I think. I got the names of them, of us on top of the hill at the time. Some had been wounded by mortar fragments. But there were about 3 of us at that stage who I think were still unwounded. Anyway, the next thing that happened was a mortar fragment hit me on the head in my steel helmet. And like some of the others, I was knocked out. And I don't remember anything more until considerably later, when the Germans, by this time, had reoccupied the hill. There was no further shooting against them. At one stage, when we were on the top of the hill there, the 7 or 8 of us there, I said to the men around me, "Why aren't you shooting towards the Germans with your rifles?" And they said, "Oh, I don't think we've most of us got revolvers. We haven't got rifles because we're at the headquarters and we're intelligence people and so on. We're Colonel Manners's intelligence section mainly, and we all have revolvers." So I said, "All right, you better shoot your revolvers, but shoot for something." And I fired off my carbine. I had an American carbine with 5 magazines, 4 magazines in 2 of the pouches. Each pouch held 2 magazines and 1 magazine in the gun. And I think there were 20 rounds in a magazine. So I had about 100 rounds for this magazine, and I was shooting off my carbine. This was before I was hit on the head. Anyway, ultimately the Germans had reoccupied the hill and started to collect what prisoners they could. There were ultimately, 4, including myself, 14 prisoners, of whom about half were wounded. And the next day, the Germans searched the whole hill, and 14 Marine dead were found. So the total losses in the attack by a commando and a half came to 28, of whom 14 were prisoners and 14 were dead. And that's all. The dead were all collected and taken down the hill, and a large trench was dug, and they were all put in and buried.
When you came to, were you in a place receiving medical treatment?
I didn't really need very much. My helmet had, to a great extent, saved me. There was a furrow cut in the helmet, and my scalp had been cut at the top, and some blood had trickled down between my eye and my ear, down the side of my face. But it had then congealed, and there's no doubt about it that the steel helmet had partly deflected the mortar fragment upwards, I think, and my head was only cut, really. I kept the steel helmet for a long time as a relic. I'd worn it in the commando raid at Vargso, where I had also been wounded, and the brim of the helmet had been bent down on that occasion. So now the helmet had two wounds on it, a bent down bit of the brim, and this furrow cut in the top. And I was rather keen on this helmet. You couldn't see this because I normally wore the camouflage net over it. But if you took the net off, you would see this very well. And I thought this is going to be a nice relic at the end of the war. But to my horror, sometime later, when I got dressed up for battle on one occasion, my servant said to me, "Oh, I saw your helmet was damaged and I got you a new one." So I said, "Good God, where's the old one?" And he said, "Oh, that's been thrown away." So I said, "Well, that is extremely annoying. I'd kept that one, and that's why it had, you didn't know it had been down, you'd been damaged." And I said, "A bit had been done at Vargson, a bit had been done at this other action. Why have you thrown it away?" And he said, "Well, I didn't think it was any good. So I was able to get a new one, so I went to the corner store and got a new one. So I'm sorry to say that I've no longer got this rather prized relic."
How are you treated by the Germans on capture?
Oh, reasonably, quite reasonably. When we were rounded up, we were taken to the German position and put down in a fairly deep hole in the ground with about 10 feet deep with a sloping ramp so that you could walk down into it. And at the bottom of this hole, there was a charging engine charging wireless batteries, and they put us in there. Well, in no time, of course, most of this perishing hole was full of exhaust gas. And so almost immediately I shouted out to the Germans and said that we can't possibly be here. This is full of petrol fumes and so on. So we came out and lay on the ground. Then, when dawn came, of course, there's nobody there at all, and everybody had, all the commandos had gone home by that time, and as was arranged, and the Germans were in possession once more of their positions. And so they all got out and were very efficient. They all re-camouflaged every single one of their posts. Some of the camouflage ferns and branches and so on of their posts had been blown off by artillery fire, and some had been burnt off, and the Germans most efficiently re-camouflaged everything. They then distributed all their food and water to these posts, and everyone sat on the banks of the, on the edges of the posts, unless an airplane came along, when they all jumped in and hid. But it was pretty efficiently done. Now, we were put in a small stone sort of potting shed at the base of the hill, which the Germans had used at one time, some of their wounded to be in, and some of the sand in the on the floor of this small shed was bloodstained. So when we went in there, and I could see in daylight to this blood, I made the prisoners, we were all crammed in there, but we scooped out this blood-soaked sand and we sat there, apart from the time when we were digging the trench to bury the dead and so on.
Now, when you were sent back, did you go to a prisoner of war camp?
Yes. Right. Now, I stayed with the Germans for 3 days and three nights because they couldn't really get me away. Then, finally, they arranged for a light tank and a small car to take me from their position to the harbour on the north of Brach. And from there, I was going to be taken by motorboat across a short strip of water to the mainland. And this, in due course, took place. I saw one or two wounded Marines who were with the Germans, who'd been picked up and taken to their aid post earlier, who'd been found wounded in the hill at this place. And I think two of them came over in the motorboat with me to the mainland. There, I was met by a tank and a car, and we drove to General Kubler's headquarters. He was the German general commanding the 118th Division. And when I got there in the early morning, I went into a room where, in a house, where a German officer was sleeping. It was very early morning, and he was woken up, and he got up, and we had some coffee to drink and so on. And I, who had some of my things with me, decided to shave. While I was doing this, it was rather interesting. A German orderly came into the room and unhooked from the wall a picture of Hitler, which was on the wall, and went out with it. And I thought this was a little bit odd, but didn't worry very much about it, but I did just notice that he did it. Later in the morning, when I went to see General Kubler, I went in with an escort, with an officer escort, and a German with an automatic. And we sat down in front of Kubler, and Kubler said through an interpreter, it is a misfortune to be captured in war and wounded, which I think you were, but it's a misfortune that can happen to anybody. But it's all over now, and it'd be interesting to talk about the battle. Perhaps you'd like to tell me a little about it on your side. And I jumped to my feet, and he said, oh, no, sit down, don't stand up. Sit down, that's perfectly all right. Said, I'm very sorry, I can only give my number, rank, and name, which I have already done. I can't discuss anything. And he said, oh, that is a pity. It might be quite interesting for both of us, and I could tell you about some of our things. I said, well, that is not very interesting, as I'm a prisoner, but it might help you if I could tell you something. But I'm very sorry to say that it is a rule that, as is always done by your people, the main thing when dealing with Germans is always to try and put things back onto them. And I was at great pains all along to say how good Germans had been, and that I was only doing what they all did as well, which I thought would please the person I was talking to. So I said, no, the Germans can only give their number, rank, and name, and so on, and we do the same. Now, I'm sorry, I can't give you any information. And he said, oh, well, I'm sorry about that. That's a pity. And then he said, well, perhaps you could talk about the Americans. So I again said, well, I'm sorry, but they're allies of ours, and I can't talk about the Americans or the partisans or anybody else. Just number, rank, and name, and nothing else whatever. And he said, ah, so.
What happened next?
What
happened next?
Then I got up and went back again to the officer's room where I had been originally. And they gave me some coffee and bread and so on. Jam, I think it was. But I noticed shortly afterwards that the same soldier came in with a picture of Hitler and hung it up back again on the wall. I subsequently discovered that it was a rule at a German headquarters that you had to have a picture of Hitler on the wall. And I had rather imagined that at one stage the adjutant or someone had said to the general, I think, General, if we are interviewing an English officer, we perhaps ought to have the statuary picture of Hitler on the wall. And the general said, oh, yes, that's a good idea. Well, has anyone got a picture of the Allhurst? And somebody said, well, I believe Hermann Schroeder has, or whatever his name was. So he said, well, better get it and hang it up on the wall behind me. Which was quite an amusing little incident.
What did they do with you next?
Well, then... Now, I should try and think what happened next. The next thing that was happened was that a German tank as escort and a large number of soldiers in a truck and myself in another one left Kubler and we went off to the town of Mostar. At Mostar, some other people came to ask me questions, but I had no difficulty in not telling them anything. There was no difficulty about that.
Were they ordinary German army people?
Yes, yes. But I said to the Germans, now, I'm pretty hungry. Everybody looks after me, but nobody has thought it important to feed me. What about having something to eat? And so the German officer said this. He said, oh, good Lord, yes, haven't you had a problem? That's why I said, I haven't had any since yesterday, I think it was. He said, oh, well, I'll give you something to eat. And he opened his briefcase. And another thing which I also discovered later on, German officers are great ones for carrying leather briefcases about with them, quite thick briefcases with straps holding them, but they're mostly full of food, not papers. And they often have bread and cheese and sausage and things that sort in. And this fellow produced some of his stuff. And I said, well, thank you very much. This is rather good. I've then discovered that this was frequently the case, that these leather briefcases they carried had much more to eat in it than they had in the way of papers. So I had a bit of a meal there and spent the night there. The next thing that happened was they said, now you will be flown to Berlin. So tomorrow morning early, we will go to the aerodrome and you'll be taken to Berlin to go to a prisoner of war camp. As we motored to this aerodrome, I noticed with great interest a very attractive, very round, circular bridge at Mostar, a very old bridge over the river, I don't know, River Neretva or whatever it was in Yugoslavia. And this I particularly noted, and I didn't see it again until 1 year when we went on holiday to Yugoslavia. And there I was pleased to see again the bridge which I'd noted so well back in 1944. Anyway, at the aerodrome, which was a grass one, we sat down and waited, and finally a Fieseler Storch, which is a small German aeroplane, came down, and I thought, which is rather like an Auster, good Lord, have I been flown away in this thing? Well, if the pilot and I are the only people in it, and I shouldn't think there's more room than that, it'll be marvellous, because unless I'm handcuffed, even if I am handcuffed, which I wasn't, of course, I believe I could force the pilot to fly over to the island of Wies. However, when we walked over to the Fieseler Storch, I saw with interest that it was a three-seater, all seats in tandem. In front sat the pilot controlling the aeroplane, and it was a very narrow aeroplane. I sat in the middle, and behind me sat a German NCO with a Tommy gun. It was a three-seater aeroplane, so there's certainly no chance of me leaning over and grabbing the pilot by the neck without having my head smashed in by the NCO behind me. So that went wrong. So there's no chance of doing anything there. Now, the aeroplane came down at a town sometime later. And there again, there was a long wait. And this time, a Heinkel 111 came in with a number of Germans in it and taxied to a stop. and German officers got out. One was a cavalry officer who could talk good English, and he came over to me and was my sort of officer escort. And we then went off to a German Air Force officer's mess, where we had a meal, luncheon. I was particularly impressed how well turned out all the German officers were. Their uniform forms were very good, and they're very attractive uniforms, grey with silver braid and so on, and their hats were all new. Everything was extremely clean, extremely neat, and pretty new looking. And I was very much impressed with their general turnout. I sat at the end of a table, and on my right sat my German cavalry officer who could talk good English, and all the rest of the table was filled up with ordinary German officers who were interested to look at me and so on. I was dressed not at all well. I had drill shorts on. It was very hot at the time of the attack we did in Broch. And at the time, I was wearing a drill shirt and drill shorts. My commando boots and my stockings rolled down in a roll over the top of my boots, so that my legs from the top of my boots to the bottom of my shorts were entirely bare. Then I had my khaki shorts, and I only had a shirt. But when I'd been with the Germans in Broch, I'd said to them, "Look here, can you get me a battle dress, a top, from some of the Marine dead?" And they said, because I said, "I'm very cold." Now, the Marines in the attack, 43, all attacked with their battle dress tops on. It was a night attack. And although I had walked over there rather earlier, I hadn't put a battle dress top on, so I was only in a shirt and shorts. And they gave me the tunic of a Marine captain. And there were two Marine captains killed in the battle, so it was probably either Scully or the other ones, one of their tunics. So I had only killed